My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I was sitting there thinking tonight, which is a dangerous thing to do, but, you know, I'm kind of a sentimental guy. And I was thinking, you know, it kind of called my attention tonight that if someone would tell me I had one day left to live, I think, what would I do? I think I would have maybe Clay and Bob and Sam come over and talk to me. It would make that day seem like forever. I'm glad to see our Sunday morning speaker. Johnny has joined us tonight. Oh, I don't... Hardly worth a standing ovation, but I know he's had a difficult time getting here, and I want to bring him up to date because he's tomorrow morning speaker. Well, last night we had a very excellent speaker, Ken D, California. He talked Johnny about how he'd worked the steps, and he was on an inner trip within himself to find a better understanding of himself and the steps. This morning we had a minister named Ray who was a drunken Baptist or something. Wound up in some kind of a home somewhere. Then Francine talked, who in two different states has failed the bar 6 times. I identify with being a lawyer. I was up all night last night trying to break a widow's will. And this afternoon, Jim W. from Fort Worth gave one of his down-home specials, and oh shit, buy the tapes. I'm very pleased to be here. I've had a very nice weekend. Really started off badly. Planes were late coming in on Thursday afternoon, and my bag did not make the switch in Orlando. And I got to Orlando, to Jacksonville. My bag didn't come. I waited till the next plane. It didn't come on that. And I waited till the next plane. It didn't come on that. And finally came up here and had to go to bed without my special jammies. They've got little bears on them. Well, not. I send those to Bobby Earl. This morning it was delivered. I got up early this morning, called the airport, and they found it finally, and they delivered it this morning. So it was nice. And I mean, Friday morning. And I had a very good day. I'm kind of a history buff. And my friends from Atlanta, Johnny and Marcia, took me to Savannah. And we toured Savannah all day long, which is really outstanding if you like history and the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. My great-grandfather almost got there in 1864. He was captured over by Atlanta, but he almost brought culture to Savannah. He had this blowtorch, and the funniest thing is... And very much enjoyed the meeting last night with Ken, and see a lot of my old friends here, some people I sponsor here, and some people I've known for a long time. I've been instructed to list off some names that insist on being mentioned from Pennsylvania. I want to welcome Marty, who's the longest guy sober in the room tonight, an old friend of mine for many, many years, and Pete, and Foster, and Bill, and Dennis, I'm glad you're all here. And Tootie. Is there anybody else I'm forgetting now? Oh, we're trying to build up the sale of tapes.
I'm going to buy that some bitch. My name's on it.
We'll just throw in some other names. Bob, Jim, Fred. But I've enjoyed the evening. I've enjoyed the weekend. It's very pleasant to be here, and I want to thank Bob and the committee for inviting me to come. And it's been a good weekend. It's a good AA weekend. There's a lot of good people here and a lot of good spirit. And it's a... I should say one more. No, I'm not going to say it. Hell with it. I don't want to attack the... I don't want to attack Mr. Polk anymore. I want to attack... you. There's a guy there with... He's a new one of our new members. And we were talking earlier today, and he said, I want what you've got. And sure enough, his front teeth are all screwed up. Good for you, kid. But I used to drink, and I drank for a lot of years, and I drank because I enjoyed drinking, and I drank, and I had some problems with drinking, and I was sent to AA, and I realized AA didn't have the answer to the type of problems I had, really, and various therapies, and I've spent much of my life dealing with emotions that make me feel things intensely, and that is quite, you know, it's an unnatural thing. It's a natural thing, I should say. The feeling of unnaturalness is really quite natural because it turns out that most of us have felt that way. If there's a unifying emotion amongst all the alcoholics I've ever known, it is they each have that deep-seated feeling, but my case truly is different. And we laugh about that, but I'm sure that is the one reason that makes alcoholics die. I know of nothing else that makes alcoholics die, other than at least to the degree of that, but my case truly is different. And I'll tell you something else that's kind of touching and sad. As far as I'm concerned, you never ever get rid of that feeling. It may fall asleep for some time, and it may not be very visible, but you wait till the next time you get upset, or the next time somebody thwarts you, or the next time somebody hurts your feelings, or the next time cuts you, you will find that right back there again. I am different. And that feeling of difference is what, it's a unifying thing, but as far as I know, that is what kills alcoholics. Now, you say, I guess we're all going to die because we all feel different. But that's not the case. You know, I travel around a lot, and people say, I've got your tapes, and really helped me and all this and that. You'd think I, some guy that I've known for some time, who's lying on the sidewalk in front of me dying, if I can help somebody in Bombay, India, I should be able to help a guy who I like dying, but I can't. Because he's let the feeling of difference get to a point where it is no longer treatable. It has become an obsessive belief. And he looks at me and he says, I know you're trying to help me, Clancy, but you don't understand. I don't suppose there's any words that are more accurate for people like me, and I presume like you. In my case is different. You don't understand. I'm sure that's why today in America, where there's more sobriety than has ever been any place in the history of the world, that they estimate still maybe 95% of alcoholics still die drunk today. And they die convinced of one thing. But my case is different. You don't understand. And it's really kind of spooky. And it's that way all over the world. In the last few years, I've had the opportunity to talk in exotic places like New Zealand and Berlin, and Paris, and London, and Dublin, and Glasgow, and Frankfurt, and a lot of places. Next month, I'm going to go down to talk at the National Convention of South Africa. In fact, they called me a couple weeks ago and said, boy, really be on your toes. We got some guys down here who really feel their case is different. Oh, have you really? I'll hurry right down. Christ, that's a big one. I think the classic example of it all is I was in Berlin about probably 3 months after the wall had started to come down. In fact, I took a little chisel and I got pieces of the wall that I passed out to some of the people I sponsored. And we were just a few blocks from Checkpoint Charlie, which is where all the spies used to go in and out. And it was very exciting. And I was talking at a meeting, but the night before I went to a little English-speaking meeting where they did a kind of discussion meeting. And I knew that for the first time, people were coming through Checkpoint Charlie from East Berlin, and people from West Berlin were going through East Berlin. And I went through East Berlin and saw this great, dreadful miasma that was communist China, Germany. And I knew I'd hear something there because people could talk about freedom for the first time. And sitting in that meeting and hear some guy behind me say,
But I don't think you really understand. I'm afraid my case is different.
See you down to the coffee shop, Hans.
Yeah.
Same old crap. I could have stayed, I could have heard that in Santa Monica. And so one of the hardest things I think that we sometimes have to do in AA is remember that people come here feeling differently. That giving them information is all very nice, but when the wall's in place, it just bounces right off. Some outstanding people gave me a message year after year after year around AA, and it bounced right off, and I had no idea that I wasn't getting all there was to get. It just didn't work. Because there are certain things that people like me, I'm sure that some of you have in common with me. My problems are the kind of things that the therapies AA has to offer does not really address. For instance, my problems are, it isn't really alcohol. It is kind of, but it really isn't. Because what people don't understand is that I don't drink because I think it's fun to drink. I drink because that's the only thing I know that makes me feel the way people look. That's why I drink. I drink because I have emotions that are not very pleasant emotions that I'm ashamed of. When I can even identify, can't always identify, but I can feel them. Emotions like, for some reason, I don't know, I don't feel like I'm quite good enough. I don't know why I'm not quite good enough, but people seem to act like I'm not quite good enough. People seem to like each other more than they like me for some reason. People don't accept me like the way they accept other people. When there's getting together, they'll get together before I'll get with it, and on and on. And when people talk to me, it's as though they somehow know I'm not enough, but nobody ever tells me what the hell it is that I'm missing. And I discovered as a young man, you got to work little games, you got to have little defenses, you have to have little poses, little things you do, little games you play, kind of. So they don't understand that you're not good enough. And that's a big thing that's always bothered me. It's hard. When you meet people, you have to always instantly decide, who do they want me to be? I don't want you to be laughing like that, you dumbbell. This is serious stuff. Wait till I get to the part where I commit suicide. You'll like that. Well, I knew I shouldn't have talked about drinking. They're starting to peel off over there. Seems to me I've lived a lot of my life with fear. And it's just a natural thing. I don't even think much about it. Never thought much about it. It's just natural. It's always there. It's something I have to... It comes and goes sometimes without any reason. I used to think if I could ever get to be something, I'd get rid of this fear. And I got to be something, and the fear intensified. Because now I'm afraid they're going to find me out. I don't know what they're going to find out, but they're going to find out I'm not enough. Somehow. So you got to play games. Everything is always a role. You have to play games. I have the feeling much of my life. I know we have some new people here tonight. Some of the newer people, I suspect, are slippers because nobody ever got looking that good in 7 days. I don't judge. But when I was 7 days, I hadn't even changed my diaper yet. I'm sure that some of you are sitting out there feeling emotions and wondering, Jesus, all these speakers seem to know all about their lives. First, I felt this, then I felt this, and I, you know. It really gets depressing because you're the only one who's just...
I don't know what's happening.
Hello. As the old saying goes, waiting for the silver tube to land and say, time to get in and go home. I want to explain this to the new people. Most of the old people know this. A few years ago, I took my son, who was then a young boy, to Gettysburg, and I'm an authority on the Battle of Gettysburg, I said modestly. And I gave him a talk on the Battle of Gettysburg. I gave him an hour and a half. I gave him more than any guide there knows. When we were touring Savannah yesterday, I had to correct the guide once or twice. When I got off for a second to get a drink, well, she must have forgot I was off and drove off. I don't worry. Well. But I mean, I told this kid about, you know, from the first cavalry guys with repeating rifles holding off the Confederate troops, the first day falling back, second day on Cemetery Ridge, third day on. I gave this kid about an hour and a half, and I really gave it to him. And I looked down after about an hour and a half, and he just... He finally said, you really know a lot about the Battle of Gettysburg. I said, you bet I do, kid. I know more about it than anybody that fought in it. He said, oh, is that so? But that's true. I know more about anybody, about the Battle of Gettysburg, than anybody who fought in it. As anybody who reads about it does. Because I've read much of what all the generals were thinking, what they were trying to do, what all the people were trying to do, what colonels were trying to do with their regiment, on and on. The people in the battle didn't know that. All they know is, oh, shit, here they come again. That's about all you know. And that's the way it is with our lives. You know, in retrospect, we've all talked about it, so I can tell you what I thought and what I did and my feelings. But when I was living through it, it wasn't like that. It was just, oh, shit, here they come. Retrospect makes us all very wise and knowledgeable. But one of the more intense feelings in my life that I couldn't always identify, but I always lived with, was the feeling of, I feel things too intensely. Other people don't seem to feel things intensely. Whatever insulation people are supposed to get, I don't seem to have mine, because I things that bounce off other people get to me. And these are the kind of things that just... These and many other feelings. Most of them I just felt all the time. Just felt a lot. Not constantly, but comes and goes, comes and goes. And I always wanted to be something, because I always felt if I could really be something, I'll get rid of these feelings. And that doesn't work either, because when you're in that kind of a mood and you're wanting to be something to make up for it, you'll discover you really don't want to be something. You want to prove to them. You want to show them. You want to make them sorry they've not treated you right. And there's never enough. There's never enough. No matter who you show, there's always somebody a level higher who you haven't showed yet. And it's an endless battle. So when I was a young man, I went to psychoanalysis. I've talked about this many times, but it really was... People in AA say you shouldn't go to psychoanalysis. I loved it. I made breakthroughs that would bring tears rolling down your cheeks. I discovered that, much to my surprise, I had been psychologically warped and repressed much of my life without even being aware of it. Now we talked about, Jim was talking today about being a Southern Baptist and how they pray for Catholics. The Norwegian Lutheran Church, he says the Lutherans do a little of everything. Not true. That's the Missouri Synod Lutherans. The Norwegian Lutherans pray for the Southern Baptists. We have missionaries in Texas. Whenever you see someone smiling, you know, there's a person in peril. And I was raised in this church, and it seemed good to me. They only really have, as far as I was a kid, I grew up in a little town, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where there's someone here from Eau Claire, incidentally. And they only really have two rules, kind of the Norwegian Lutheran Church, as far as I could tell. You don't ever sin, and you don't monkey with Catholics. And that's pretty much it. And I was weak, so I sinned, and then I got monkeyed with Catholics. And I got sinning with Catholics, actually. But it didn't seem bad to me. It was only... But except later in psychoanalysis, I discovered that the Norwegian Lutheran Church had left me with distorted perceptions and had psychologically scarred me. Now, how would you like to find out that your church has left you with warped perceptions when you didn't even know it? I went into a terrible funk. If I knew then what I know now, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. We could have got together once a week and just been pissed off. I discovered that I'd been hurt by the Depression. I discovered I'd been hurt by my parents. I discovered all... God, it's just made... I used to have tears rolling down my cheeks. I just loved it. And I never knew why. In fact, years later, when I was sober for some years, I used to think, why did I love psychoanalysis so much in those years? I spent thousands of dollars. I spent years at it. Not years at it, but all that I could. We have a friend named Mary Regan, some of you know, who's been sober 31 years, classmate of Johnny's. And she has a line, I would never say this because it's beneath my dignity, but she says it, so I'll quote her. My approach to psychoanalysis was like Mary's approach talks about to drinking, about the cat making love to the skunk. I didn't get all I wanted, but I got all I could stand. That's what that Mary Regan, that's why you never hear her talk on the circuit, because she's dirty, that's why. But anyway. Her sponsor's done the best he can with her, but... But I wonder why I like psychoanalysis, you know, because it really... I went to it a lot. I never got any good news ever. There was always some bad news, and it cost me money to get it. And it wasn't until years later, in the last maybe 4, 5, 6 years, that I began to understand why I love psychoanalysis. Because I've seen other therapies around us doing the same thing for people, whether intentionally or not, I have no way of telling, but doing the same thing. And what psychoanalysis did for me, I'll tell you what psychoanalysis did for me. In my opinion, the two greatest emotions, the most painful emotions of my life, probably the most two most painful emotions in my life. One of them was certainly guilt. I've always carried a lot of guilt. I have no way to get rid of guilt. Drinking got rid of guilt. One of the reasons I drank. But you can't get rid of guilt. And psychoanalysis got rid of guilt for me. And I see other therapies getting rid of guilt for people today. Now, wouldn't that be nice? Sure it would. Do you know how you get rid of guilt? You go to a therapy that convinces you you are a victim. Victimization. Because if it's their fault, it's not my fault. And even if I act badly today, it's because they put this pattern in me 50 years ago. Nothing is ever my fault, really. And I'll tell you, it's impossible to get rid of guilt quickly. I only know of two ways to do it. Drinking and victimization. And that's why victimization has become such a popular thing, I am convinced. Now, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with being a victim? Right? If you get rid of guilt, that's a great thing. Guilt is a terrible thing to carry. There's only one thing, unfortunately, you'll discover in this field of victimization, is that there's never any free lunches in the world. And in victimization, there's a little price tag you pay. And in fact, there's three little price tags you pay. They don't seem like terribly much, but you got to pay them. One, to maintain victimization, whether you intend to do it or not, or whether the therapist intends to have you do it, you must sustain and enhance feelings of resentment toward these people who've done it to you. Because that is what, if you ever go to these therapies, and there's several of them, where they talk about who did what to them and made them the way they are, you will never see anyone leave those meetings smiling because they have reinforced and enhanced the feelings of resentment towards them. Another, the second thing you have to pay on a continuing basis is
you must pay a continual feeling of self-pity, because it's quite obvious. I would have been normal and happy and had no negative emotions if they hadn't done this to me. That's one of the great things they preach in these therapies. Every negative thought you have, it's their fault. They never tell them that about 99% of the negative thoughts you have are human behavior. It is their fault. And the third little price tag you have to pay is that you must continually live with the feeling of being different. I would have been fine if they hadn't screwed up my life, if she hadn't done this to me, if he hadn't, if they hadn't. So, what's the big deal about that? Maybe that's worth it. Maybe it's worth it to pay that kind of a price to get rid of guilt. And apparently it is for some people, because those meetings are full, many places. But for people like me, and I presume like you, we have to come to understand in that little blue book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that's been around here during the weekend, it almost specifically states the three most lethal emotions for people like me and you: resentment, self-pity, and feelings of difference. So these are lethal, deadly emotions. And I'll tell you, I sustained victimization for years, and they were the worst years of my life, and yet I thought I had found the most truth. So victimization, and I'm not putting down victimization therapy, don't misunderstand me, because truly, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we take no official opinion of any other therapy, neither for or against it, endorse it or against it. But I think it'd be safe to say, no, you know what I'm going to say? I'm going to say something absolutely, as far as I'm concerned, absolutely non-controversial. I don't want to go to AA meetings and hear that stuff being peddled here. Yeah. I hope their meetings are full, and I hope they're all making breakthroughs right and left. But I don't want to go to an AA meeting and hear about your issues with your inner child any more than I would go to their meeting and insist they read the 12 traditions. It's two different things. If you want that, go there. If you want to recover, go here. If you want to and that's, people say you're attacking them. I'm not attacking them. I'm just saying, Alcoholics Anonymous, what with the climate of the world, we better keep this little thing pure, because that's all we got, baby. It's none too easy when it's pure. And if it gets mixed up, it really gets to be exciting. But I find that today there's a lot of people getting mixed up, and they bring in stuff from treatment centers, and they come to AA with information they've got, as someone was said, with 8 months of sobriety, he's finally got their certification as a senior counselor, and who are telling them about that, well, you have to be an alcoholic to be an AA. It's all one big disease. I'll tell you who created that statement: a treatment center with only one van. That's who created that one. It is not one big, it may be one big disease to some people, to outside people, but we know different. That is why Alcoholics Anonymous and the Washingtonians are the only two therapies that have ever been successful for the treatment of alcoholism, because they are the only two that base themselves on one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. Every other therapy has combined and mixed and matched. And that doesn't work, apparently, with people who feel different. But I had these feelings and a lot of other feelings, and I read books, and I, kind of an imitation intellectual, and I tried to, you know, read things that you don't understand. And I was talking about German philosophers. I went through a German philosophy thing, and if you're reading by yourself, you think, see? What? It's in English, but it doesn't seem to be, you know. But if there are people looking, you say, how true.
And I was, I guess like most people, although I didn't know it, I was always a great idealist. I wanted things to be right, and I wanted people to be right. I guess what you call perfectionist. You know, it's an interesting thing. In the 1950s, Yale University had the first and only big school of alcoholic studies. Later, went to Rutgers. But they really had tests, and they brought in alcoholics, and they had known alcoholics and known non-alcoholics, and they had psychological testing and physiological testing, all kinds. It really was the masterwork. I mean, for example, they'd give alcoholics on one morning two drinks and known non-alcoholics two drinks and see if they could measure a difference. You know, I'm off, it sounds pretty nice, except you ever think being in that test, here's your second drink, thanks. Well, that's all for today.
Bullshit it is.
And they put out a study this thick, but boiled down to really, to oversimplify it, they only found two things that, as far as they could tell, the alcoholics they studied had in common. One, they all ranked very high in a percentile of perfectionism. They all wanted things to be perfect. And most of them had two speeds. If it isn't perfect, screw it. And the other one was they had a different psychological test difference after they drank alcohol. And nobody could understand that. Why would that be? Nobody could understand that. And who would guess that? But nothing else was in common. All backgrounds and differences and psychological backgrounds and sociological backgrounds and so on. But I think, like many people, I have always been kind of a perfectionist. I want things to be right, and I'm willing to do anything to make them right and to keep them right. And things never stay right. In retrospect, as I look at my life now, I think my life was consistent and occasionally does now. Everything I ever talk about in the past occasionally creeps up to me today. I envy those people who have been able to put away all emotions behind them.
When I drank, it was like that. But today,
she. I don't thank him after their talk. I just kind of touch the hem of their garment. I guess I represent the fallible wing of AA. I've not achieved that nirvana yet. It's a continuing rear view action. But I. Most of my life, I've had the feeling that if I could just make everything right, and in retrospect, I see I wanted things to be wonderful. God, that's all. That's what I want in life. I want my love to be wonderful. I want her to be wonderful. I want my job to be wonderful. I want my home to be wonderful. I want my car to be wonderful. I want my friends to be wonderful. And I'll do anything to bring it about. And I never could sustain it. And I always took this as some sort of a terrible distraction, some terrible letdown. It wasn't until sober some years that I began to understand the basic nature of human behavior. Some people never learn this. Nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. Nothing. It can be rich and fine, but it's not wonderful, because wonderful to me is a 16-year-old tingly emotion. And you can't sustain that for anything. You know, as the old example I always use about that word that's been used several times at this podium this weekend, where sponsor, when you're a sponsor and someone calls you and they say that word that sends a shiver down the spine of any sponsor. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. And if you're really quick on your feet, you say things like, "Oh, Mr. Emerson not in today. He go home a long time ago." You know? Because there's nothing more tedious in the world than a newcomer's relationship. Jeez. They say you shouldn't have a relationship in your first year. That's not for your sake. That's for your sponsor. And, you know, they always say versions of the same thing. "Oh, but this is really the one. I know I thought the other one was, but this is what I... God, when I saw her walking out of detox..." And you don't know whether to tell them the bad news or not. You know. Oh, I know this is the one. God, we were having lunch today, and we reached for the salt shaker. My hand brushed hers, and I swear to God, there was a shock. It was a spark. I could just feel it. Another thing I got to patent someday for A sponsors, an aha machine. Just put the phone on the machine. Uh-huh. 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 But you always have to judge whether you're going to tell them the facts of life. That no matter how much you love this girl, you know, that even if the one in a billion chance that your relationship lasts and you, 3 years from now, you're married and having your little child, and just wonderful. It isn't going to stay this way because this is not real. This is not the real world. No matter how much you love her and how rich and wonderful it is, 3 years from now, if you sit to have lunch and you reach for the salt and your fingers touch, you're going to say, "Give me the goddamn salt." It's just the fact of life. And But people like me want it to be wonderful or else I feel disillusioned. I feel betrayed and put upon without ever consciously thinking of those words. Most people who come to AA who are very cynical are cynical because they have been disillusioned again and again by watching things not be perfect and not watching people not be perfect. And I discovered, I've tried a lot of therapies for it, but when I was a boy, 15 years old, full of either enthusiasm or neurosis, I ran away from home, and I had my first drink on the deck of a ship in Pearl Harbor, a small and skinny and a pimply-faced little puke. And I had, early in the Second World War, just 15, and I'd promised my mother and grandmother I'd never touch whiskey, but these were men I was felt terribly inadequate to, and I was more determined to get their approval than stay loyal to my mother's promise. So I took a drink, and it made me sick, and I threw up. And I remember them laughing, sneering laughter. I don't suppose for people who feel inadequate like I have about much of my life, there's any single thing that is more hurtful than feelings of public humiliation. I'll tell you, to this day, if I have any saying at all, nobody I sponsor owns a handgun. Now that sounds silly. But I've seen over the years, a couple times, people who in a moment of public humiliation or instant rage have gone crazy and done something they wouldn't have done a minute later. Just that instant, white flash. That's why I don't want them to have alcohol in their house. Have in the garage if you want. I want air to hit your face so it isn't that instant. Some of you remember a very famous AA speaker named Eddie Regan. Great guy. That's what he talked about. 10 years sober. Doing well. Doing well. In the kitchen, his wife just ground him once too often when he was tired. He said, "That bitch!" And without even thinking, reached him out a bottle of whiskey. And had a hell of a time getting back. And spent the rest of his life explaining why he didn't have whiskey where he could reach it in that instant, blind, white flash. They say, if you're going to drink, you're going to drink it anyway. That may be if you're thinking about it. But I'm talking about that white heat. If you're like me, you know that feeling. It doesn't come very often. When it comes, boy, it's lethal. It can be lethal. And that's what that did for me there, public humiliation. I thought to myself, I had no tools to fight back. If I could smash them, I would have, but they're all big and I'm a little puke. I thought later, there's only one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. I would have been thrown overboard. I might have said, "Hey, buddy, lean over." "Yeah, what do you want?" "Take that." Yeah. Which would not have been very good. But so I tried to learn to drink, and I drank. When nobody was looking, for the next few days, I took a drink of alcohol every day, stuck in this guy's sea bag. And I hated it, but one day I held one down, and it made me sick, because all I could do was hold it down. And all of a sudden, I remember, I felt significantly better. That's all I knew. And I understood then why people drank. You know, there's a book out now that's been out last year. All I ever really needed to know, I learned in kindergarten. That's a bunch of crap. I never learned anything in kindergarten. I didn't even learn to sleep on my rug. You learn life when you're in your teens. That's when you learn life. You learn about the stirrings within you. You learn drinking. You learn smoking. You learn about love and your relationships and lust and having to work. And you discover people are going to take care of you forever. And on and on and on. Some things are good and some are bad. But that's when you learn about life. And I learned about life. I learned about smoking and drinking and love and all this stuff. And I discovered that drinking was something that made you feel good. I look back now and I can see what drinking did for me. I didn't know it then because I just was, oh, here they come again. But drinking made me feel the way those men looked. And I had never felt that way before. And I know now that men don't feel as well as they look. So I was feeling better than they were. But I didn't know it, but it made me feel good. And I didn't become a terrible old drunk and staggering around the world. Like everything else, I tried to learn to do it and watch men do it and hung around with men and sometimes got drunk and they kidded me. And at the end of the war, I was in a naval hospital up in Northern California. Had nothing to do with drinking. And I've thought about this, talked about this for years. Only the last 3 or 4 years have I thought about it. Something miraculous happened. They were trying to get rid of them. The Red Cross Gray Ladies were trying to get rid of some paperwork they had. So they passed around a bunch of tests. And I guess I was in a good mood. Because even then, I was a defiant, smart mouth because I was often afraid. And that's why defiant, smart mouths often act. They are afraid and they act defiant and smart mouth to disguise it. But they said, take these tests. And if I were in one of my defiant moods, I said, I'm not going to take any tests. If I'd have been a smart, rather take a test and write all the answers wrong just to show how cute I was. But I did it right. I had no idea what the test was for. And I took quite a long test, and I took it. And I'd always done a lot of reading, so I did pretty well. And I had no idea what it was for, except that 2 or 3 weeks later, they came by and said, congratulations, Clancy. Here's your high school diploma. Armed Forces Institute, test for high school equivalency. So I had a high school diploma. Not really a diploma, but equivalency. So after the war, I always thought about that, because after I got out of the Navy, if I'd have gone, had to go home, I'd have to start my junior year of high school. And I never would have done that. I never would have become a junior in high school again. So I don't know what I'd have done in my life. I'd have been in bad shape, but instead I had a high school diploma, and I was a discharged veteran, and I went to college. And the first class of college veterans in fall of 1946, I got married in college and did the things veterans do when we all stood around the campus and looked like steely-eyed, sex-crazed killers and wondering if our unemployment check would come in time. And around the world, I became a sports writer on newspapers. Then I got into advertising and then public relations and worked on the... Had some successes over the years. And I'll tell you, alcohol, as far as I was concerned, made most of it possible. Because of myself, I am afraid, I am sensitive. But when I drink, it changes me. In retrospect, I now know what alcohol does for me. I didn't then, I just felt it. But now I know. Alcohol has the power, apparently, unnatural ability to almost instantly take a person who doesn't feel like they're enough, and for a while, it makes me feel like I'm more than enough. It takes a person like me who lives with a lot of fear, and it makes me fearless for a while. It takes a person like me who feels sensitive all the time with hurt feelings, all the time with feelings of rejection, and makes me almost omnipotent temporarily. It's just great. When I'm drinking, I can... You know, as a public relations man, you're supposed to make small talk, a lot of small talk. I'm terrible small talk. Today, I'm not much of a small talker. But I mean, standing around with people you're supposed to be being, and trying to think of something to say. You know. Well, going to be a scorcher tomorrow, huh? Sometimes get your courage up and say things like, boy, that fat woman in the gray dress really looks like an elephant, doesn't she? Oh, that's your wife, right? Gonna be a scorcher tomorrow.
But when I have a few drinks, man, I'm just... I'm too hip for the room. I'm right there. Algonquin round table. I'm just... Funny line. I'm so far advanced, people don't understand it. I mean, so slick. I'm sure a lot of guys in this room, it's a negative example, but I don't know a better way to put it. I'm sure there are people like me in this room who are so sensitive to rejection. And I'm sure if alcohol helps you, as it helped me, it performs miracles in your life. I'm sure a lot of you guys have sat in a bar, perhaps late at night, having a drink or two, and watching a literal miracle happen in front of your eyes. Watching some old beast become beautiful by closing time. Sometimes you can talk with your shoulders. And I might sidle over to such an old queen and imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension. She'd like to join me in the old Chevy. Now, if she would say, now, when I'm sober, I don't know what I'd do. Of course, I wouldn't be able to ask the question. That's one thing. But if I heard that, I guess I would commit suicide. But when I'm drinking, I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her. Too bad, bitch. Don't come begging tomorrow. That might not seem like much in the Rotary Club, but boy, what a difference that makes to you and me. And I did. It helped me in a lot of ways. Alcohol is the best friend I ever had, it seemed to me. I never thought much about it. The only problem I've ever had is I have, from time to time, drink too much. And as I like to believe, I've been thoughtlessly overserved. And when I drink sometimes, I act bizarre. And I never knew why that was till I got in psychoanalysis and realized that I had been repressed as a child. And alcohol broke these bonds, and I suddenly achieved a stature that I hadn't achieved before. And it made a very lot of sense to me. It never made any sense to any cop, but it made a sense to me. But you see, I was repressed. Now, shut up and get in the car. So I was sent to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago, folks. A lot of you little snots weren't even born. We love you. And AA is a nice place, except for one thing. It has no application to people like me. Because it is designed for people whose problem is alcohol. And their therapy consists of cleaning up your act and returning to God and feeling better. And none of these things apply to me. I know more about God than they do. That's one of the problems, is because I am a very sinful man. I remember thinking, that means I've broken all the Ten Commandments. What the hell am I going to return to God? That Norwegian God does not suffer fools graciously. It wasn't until a sober few years that I was able to realize I haven't broken all the Ten Commandments. Go to your room. I hope she's here tomorrow morning, Johnny, when you and the audience start crying and she goes, ah, ha, 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 ha. Well, but I have not broken all the Ten Commandments. I have never coveted my neighbor's manservant. It's not a hell of a lot, but it's a beachhead. And my problem really isn't alcohol. And AA is a nice place, and they're good people. But there's good people in a lot of places I've been. But my case is different. I wish it weren't. So I went to therapy after that. And I went to AA from time to time, because I always drank too much eventually.
based on my emotions. Things. It's an old joke to say this, but it really is true. My life consisted of an endless series of misunderstandings and bad breaks, and things that started off well getting screwed up, and things that should have gone well and people misunderstood me, and I was trying to be funny, wasn't being vicious, and it was only a joke, and give me another chance, and I meant to be at work, and on and on and on. And I had some successes, and I had some, did pretty well sometimes. Always wound up in an explosion and have to start over. Always starting over somewhere in a new city. One spring I was nominated to be junior chamber of commerce, one of the young men of the year in the suburb of Chicago, in the springtime. By the end of that year, I was playing piano in a bar/whorehouse in San Francisco, which I wasn't. I guess it wasn't a whorehouse. It was the ground floor of a hotel, though, but couples went up, and only the girls ever came back. That's all I know. I ran into a guy I'd been in the Navy with, and he was hitchhiking to Texas. So I went to Texas and stayed down there, worked very hard, got a job on the newspaper, then on the advertising agency, then I was the faculty of the university. So in the springtime, I was working in an advertising agency in the daytime, directing an opera, doing the dramatic direction and staging of an opera at night for the University of Texas, writing a weekly column from time to time on sports for the paper. By the end of that year, I was in a Texas State Insane Asylum, committed as a psychopath, not as a drinker. There's nothing in my commitment paper said drinking. I hadn't sunk to that. This little sumbitch is crazy. Every time I hear Jim talk, it always sends a little shiver down my spine because he has a perfect accent, that middle Texas accent when they come in to the electric shock ward where you're waiting. Going to give me another one? We going to hip you. Why don't you go hip somebody else? Just slip this on him and listen to music. When you take enough electric shock treatment, says one thing about it, you forget why you were there. You just what's your name, boy? Prop, State of Texas. And I came out of those shock treatments finally, and they saw my record. I directed the opera at the University of Texas. So that winter, I directed the Christmas pageant at the Texas State Insane Asylum as part of my therapy. It was not really a complex production. The director's main job was trying to keep the three wise men off the Virgin Mary, if you possibly. But we just want to worship her, Clay Ensley. Get back, Lamar. Get back, Mirabeau. And I got out of there because they put in the first alcoholic ward in the state of Texas while I was there, and I'd been to enough AA meetings so I could pretend to be an alcoholic, and I got out. And I never had another drink until I ran out of Thorazine. But I worked very hard and made another great comeback. In the spring of that year, I was working at Tracy Locke, the largest advertising agency in the South. Some other guys now were sitting around doing these old ads. Some of you remember them. Tracy Locke did for the Borden Company, Elsie and Elmer the Cow talking. And by the later that year, I was on the floor of the Phoenix Drunk Tank, and a guy just got done kicking my front teeth out. Because that's for vomiting on my bunk, you drunken son of a bitch. And I was so sick of laying on the floor, and my guy kicked my teeth out. That was one of the few mornings I was ever really glad I'd been in psychoanalysis, I'll tell you, because it gave me at least some perception and perspective I wouldn't have had. I was able to almost instantly realize that this man is overreacting. He should seek assistance. I got out of there, and a few weeks later, I found myself being thrown out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles. The guy said, then stay out. Not because I'd an old drunk, because I was in there afraid and defiant and got in a fight. Drunk and got in a fight. I'd been asked to leave the AA club in Wilshire and Fairfax, Los Angeles, the week before that for being drunk and in a fight. I want to say to this guy, I'm not a bum. You throw me out here, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas at El Paso. Ads that I helped write are running this very week in Life and Time and Collier's and Daily Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. You know, when you have no front teeth, you can't hit those consonants quite as cleanly. And I was dying on the streets of Los Angeles, an old, dying man. My family had gone, my home had gone, my career had gone, my front teeth had gone. You can get new homes and careers, but like our book says, we are like men who have lost their front teeth. We never grow new ones. But I want to give you some hope, kid. Once you become truly spiritual, they grow back. How your sponsor explained that to you on the way home. What did that mean, Fred? Shut up. Analyze, don't utilize. And that's why it's amazing to me. If a guy would have come to me and said, your life is on the line, pal, are you an alcoholic? I would say, I'm not, but I wish I were. I've been going to AA meetings for years, off and on. And I've gone to therapy, but there's something terribly different about me, and nothing can help it. And I know, can tell you all about AA. I know I can recite the 12 steps. I know about AA. I know about the, I've read the book. I've done a lot of things. I can tell you about psychotherapy. I can tell you about Oswald Spengler. If you ever wonder, if you're a depressive, and I've always been, that's why I was committed to the Texas Nut House, because I stayed sober. I tried to get my wife through pregnancy without me being drunk, and I stayed sober. And when I stay sober too long, I get terribly depressed. And one day I couldn't stand it, and I promised I wouldn't drink, because the last time she had gone through this, I got drunk, and our son died while I was in jail. And I swore that would never happen again. I took a vow. Next time we have a baby, I will not drink no matter what. And one day it got so bad I couldn't stand it, and I couldn't drink. So I just, when they went to church, I pulled the car in the garage and hooked up a hose and went to sleep in the hospital. And determined I was a badly split personality disorder, a dual personality, schizophrenic, depressive, suicidal. It committed me for an indefinite period to the Texas State Hospital in Big Spring, Texas. And because I'm a terrible depressive like that. And I don't know what to do about it. Drinking changes that. Drinking makes me feel better. And sometimes I drink too much. And well-intentioned people think my problem is drinking, but it isn't, really. I mean, they give me a test, pull me out of my car, and have me blow up a balloon, and they can measure how much alcohol is in my blood. Why don't they have a test that'll measure, give me a balloon to blow up to measure how sensitive I feel today and why I just can't stand it on the edge? They take a drop of blood out of my ear, they can measure how much I'm able to drive. Too bad they haven't got a test to measure how lonely I feel today. Even in the middle of a crowd of people. They can have me walk a white line. Where's the line I can walk so they'll know that my case is different? And there's something wrong with me. I don't know what it is. If it was, I'd fix it. So they think your problem is alcohol. And I know it isn't. I wish I were an alcoholic. I should wish I could clean up my act, return to God, and live happily ever after. Because there's no doubt it works for these people. But where do you go if it doesn't work for you? And dying on the street, I'll tell you. When I was committed to the reason I know how old I was, when I was committed to the house, I was 29. And they told me that my part of my entrance examination, I had the body, the reactions of a man 15 years older. Not about being drunk, I was sober. Just the reaction of a man 15 years older. And a couple of years ago, year ago, when I was just 65, I had another physical, and the doctor said, boy, you got the reaction of a man 10 years younger. I was an older man then than I am now by far.
I really am, because I'm young and I feel enthusiastic. I have fun then. Then the world was a gray tunnel. A gray, black, and white tunnel. That's another definition to me of drinking. If nothing else, I can't stand gray tunnels of life. And drinking, by God, whatever else it does, it adds color. It makes it technicolor. And I can't stand. You know, to this day, I sit with my grandchildren sometime and watch The Wizard of Oz at Christmas time. We have it on videotape. And at the end, after all these years, because it came out in 1939, I guess, at the end, I just want to shout, "Don't go back to Kansas! It's all black and white back there. Stay where the color is. You got a choice. There's some wicked witches, but you get used to it. I did. You know. I think probably the most touching definition I ever heard of that, I'm sure some of you do it, in that movie Days of Wine and Roses. The Playhouse 90, the guy took me to his house, a guy named Bill Lerner took me to his house, who was my sponsor momentarily. And he took me to his house, and we saw it. And I was just afraid, another one of these tracks where we're going to wind up happy and live happily ever after. The most impressive thing about that was that the woman couldn't get sober and apparently died drunk. I thought, God, that's powerful. But the great line, I'm sure you remember, because in the movie, too, they did the same thing. You may remember the plot, but he's a drinker, and he teaches his wife to drink, and they both become drunks, and they have a little baby. And then he somehow gets to A, and she can't go to A, and she won't go to A. She tries it and like it. And now he and the daughter are living together, and she's living somewhere else, and she gets cleaned up and sobered up to come over to see her daughter. And he pleads with her. Oh, he says, "Oh, please, Kristen, come to AA. Try AA. It isn't so bad, being sober." She says, "You don't understand, do you?" She took him over to the window. There's an alley down there. She said, "Look, that's a dirty alley. Look at that dirty, filthy puddle. Look at the dirt and filth down there. I can't stand dirt and filth. Can't you understand when I..." And man, we all know that feeling. I see the reflection. I see something that is... When I'm drinking, sometimes I can get tears in my eyes over sunsets, over things that are nice. When I'm sober on the natch, it's just gray tunnel. And AA doesn't help. AA is a nice place, but it's not designed for people like me. My case is different. And I thought I was the only one maybe in the world who felt like that. I didn't realize that nearly everybody like me feels that way to one extent or another with different circumstances. I think about that today sometimes. In the last 3 or 4 years, I've had 5 years, 2 or 3 people that I've sponsored who have died of cancer. In fact, this morning I had a long talk with a friend I sponsor, a man I sponsor in Oregon. His wife died this morning, a lovely lady. And Wednesday, and she had a brain tumor, and she was going blind, and she was crying and saying, "What can I do?" And I was trying to cheer her up. And I'm really glad she passed on, because that's no way to live like that. But anyway, I spent a lot of time in that, which is a great hospital. And you go for that cancer ward, and a lot of people are there for treatment, and they recover. But some of them don't recover. They die. And is always the case. And I don't know if there's time after time with these people dying and sit with them. And I'm not a kind or good man. I hate to do that. But I don't do it because I'm a kind man. I do it because I know he wants to sponsor there talking to him, and I can hide my fear and desperation. I think to myself, it's just amazing, isn't it? What if I would get up in this ward today and say, "Hey, all of you people dying who are here as a hospice, what would you say to this? I know a place, if you go with me and go to some meetings at night, drink some coffee with a bunch of people you like, would you go to that every night for an hour and a half, have a few laughs, meet some new friends, really get along, if I could cure your cancer?" God, they would offer you their homes, their cars, everything. Take me. If you really want to see probably the most horrible single sight that I know in America today,
go to the Los Angeles County Hospital, which is the charity hospital, and go to the charity AIDS ward. Really hideous. No, nothing nice about that. Really grim. And these skinny people all dying with their open sores and nobody really cares. I mean, they have no people bringing them things and so on. The nurses and doctors treat them as well, but they, you know. And I think to myself, what would happen if I would go in there and say, hey, guys, I got some sore, saying you're sorry and making praying whether or not you believe in a God. Would you do these things if I could cure your AIDS? They would crawl across the floor and lick your feet. They would lick your feet for a chance. But you go to an alcoholic ward in that same hospital where men are dying. Their liver out to here. Eyeballs are yellow. Skin is yellow. Saying, come on. We're going to have an AA meeting. Not me, pal. I'm not an alcoholic. Not me. I'm no goddamn alcoholic. And it's kind of funny, except you go back next month and he's dead and there's a new guy in the bed saying he's not an alcoholic. Prove he's not an alcoholic. You and I can certainly prove it easily anytime we work at it. Anytime. The oldest timer here, Marty back there, or the newest timer here, you can prove it anytime. Because if your mind looks for diff, so easy to see. They are people whose problem is alcohol. My case is different. Doesn't anybody understand? I'm lonely and sensitive and want things to be right. And I can't return to God because that doesn't work for me, and my problem isn't alcohol. And so all over the world, people die, and people die today. And I'm like most of you, I see people die from time to time today. I see alcoholics die, literally die. I don't mean where they say, oh, that guy's sick, but we have to tell the guy in the alley back, put a blanket over him, he's dead. And you'd think there'd be some answer to it, but there isn't any answer. It's got to be the only illness in the world in which the cure starts from the inside of the patient. Because he's got to unlock the door. And if he's gotten to a point where the door is locked and barred, you can talk till your face is blue. It might keep you sober, but it won't help him or her. And that's why it seems like the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is that somehow here, we enable people to overcome feelings of difference enough to stay sober. That's the miracle of AA. What has caused people to die for 4,000 years from alcoholism is not absence of knowledge, absence of wonderful people, medical people, religious people, physiologically knowledgeable people, psychological specialists. I'm sure you can get the information you need in many places. But none of it means anything because the door stays shut. You don't understand. I know you mean well. I know you're trying to help me. But you don't understand. I stayed sober for a little while, but it isn't working. We see that in our meetings all the time. You see them, everybody sees them. People come around for a while, and they're kind of enthusiastic. One day they don't come anymore. Never see them again. What's really ironic sometimes, and it happens in every group, I'm sure, you have some boob come who just is not the type of person you even want to come to the group. I don't want to be here, and I think it's a bunch of crap. Shut up. You get somebody else. I'm trying to find a new way of life, and I'm willing to go to any length to find an answer that'll help me break through this prison of alcohol. And a year later, the boob is getting his birthday cake, and yet you haven't seen the nice guy for 51 weeks. And I guess the answer to that one is, the boob is trying to be honest and tell how he really feels, and the nice guy is playing a game to impress me. And it's the hardest thing in the world to understand that. To me, every once in a while, I have a tendency to take AA for granted. But every once in a while, its miracle sends a shiver down my spine. I sometimes think, I can't even believe that I'm so lucky to be here. And yet, next Wednesday morning when I wake up, I may just think, oh crap, another day I listen to those babies cry and whine and go to that meeting and on and on. It's just because I'm a human being. And human beings don't rise above human emotions. But I want to just tell you, I walked 71 blocks in the rain that morning. I walked out to a club that I'd been asked to leave before. And I hung around there, and I guess the difference this time, I had no idea I was going to stay sober. Never intended to, because AA doesn't work for me. But I had a couple great blessings going for me. One, I was terribly desperate. I wasn't desperate for sobriety. I was desperate just to survive. And so I was more prone to be a little flexible, to play their sick little game until things got a little better. And so I did something in this sobriety I hadn't done before. What seemed to me at the time, I sold out my integrity. Because whatever down I'd been, at least I didn't do phony things that were goofy in order to get along. I at least maintained some integrity. But this time, I sold out and I did dumb things that I was ashamed of while I did them. Because they were nonsense. They were the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did not run. Time after time I wanted to run. I'll tell you, I had some terrible depressions in my early time in AA. And I don't mean to say that they're gone. Because once in a while now, I get a depression. But the only difference is now, I start to feel sorry and I want to stay in bed today. And another part of my head says, oh, come on, for Christ's sake. We go through this all the time. Get up and go to work. Don't you understand? No, shut up. Get up. It's the only time it's really helpful to be a schizophrenic, you know. I hear people in AA sometimes that they think they need group therapy. I don't. I just go for a ride alone in my car. Well, that's right, yeah. But I took actions, and I started meeting running a little late, miss. Mention my name, you get a good seat. She and her friend helped me tour Savannah, and that's the thanks she gets you. Extend a hand of friendship in AA, and some bastard bites it. But I want to quickly say that I've stayed sober now for a few months. It'll be 35 years. I haven't had a drink or any therapy other than Alcoholics Anonymous. And I often wonder, what's the difference? What's the difference? And the difference is primarily I began to take actions I didn't believe in. But I want to say a couple of things to this young man and a couple other people here who are new. The old-timers can doze off now and think about how you've been hurt by them. I want to tell you how I overcome two things. First of all, I said tonight that I was an alcoholic. Now, how can I be an alcoholic? Because my problem really isn't alcohol. How can I be an alcoholic? I mean, I can get up and say it. People do that. We have Al-Anons get up and say it, that they're alcoholics just because they're tired of Al-Anon. I'm not judging them, but I'm just telling you. When overeaters can't make it in OA, they come here. I'm an alcoholic. God bless him. I want you to know something. One of the things I learned by taking actions, not by knowledge, but by taking actions in desperation I didn't want to take, over a period of time, I discovered the most important single thing I've ever learned about my life, that I'm an alcoholic. And I'll tell you how I learned it. The one thing that always stood between me and becoming an alcoholic is that an alcoholic is a person whose problem is alcohol, and my problem really isn't. It looks like it and smells like it sometimes, but I know it isn't at 2 o'clock in the morning when I'm sober and I lay awake looking off into the darkness, my head going 1,000 miles an hour, trying to stay sober and knowing I need a couple drinks just to get the voices still. I'm glad that I stayed here long enough to discover this. If you hear nothing else I say tonight, you listen to this, Billy. I discovered if my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. Because that sounds strange. But another one, if I'm an alcoholic, my problem is not and cannot be alcohol. Now, doesn't that sound goofy? But I'm convinced that's the message of AA. I'm convinced that's what we do here. I'm sure I'm one of the few people in this room who ever sat and talked to Bill Wilson about it for a while. That's what he felt in 1963 in his office. I don't think he changed after that. But you say, of course the problem is alcohol. Everybody knows that. I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If the problem is alcohol, detoxes turn on recovered people. And they don't. Hospitals turn on recovered people. Treatment centers turn on recovered people. Jails turn on recovered people. They turn on people who are physically sober with varying amounts of information of what may be wrong with them. But I'll guarantee you, if they be like me, and I presume like you, most of you, unless something dramatic happens after sobriety, sooner or later they must always eventually drink or sedate. Well, if it isn't alcohol, what the hell is it? Is it something mysterious, something magic? You have to be like one of these TV guys and his inner child, or one of these adult children things where you have to send in and buy another book or another pamphlet or subscribe to some more? Nope. It's the answer is alcohol, but it's something you hear about every meeting, you hear about every time you talk about your problems. But if you are like me, your mind may resist it enough so that you never hear it. The problem here is something called alcoholism. You say, alcohol, alcoholism, same thing. Not the same thing. Terribly different. I'll guarantee if you be like me, kid, the day will come when your sanity and life will depend on remembering the difference. What is the difference? Well, very simply, an alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. In the disease of alcoholism, however, this dreadful, mind-destroying, psychologically emasculating, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you cannot stand it another day. That is what makes alcoholism a fatal illness. Not that drinking is so bad. It is bad. But sobriety, the pain of sobriety, eventually always gets worse than the remembered pain of drinking. But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. That just helps you be an alcoholic. The other thing that has to be there, Francine mentioned today, they told her she had an allergy. She went and took an allergy test. I understand that. It's funny. But they say you have to be one of those 5 or 6% of people who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. When Bill was writing this book, and the doctor, in opinion, the doctor wrote, it's kind of like an allergy of the body. He later called it a sensitivity of the body. Called it an unnatural reaction. As far back as anybody can judge, it's been going on for 4,000 years. That in every generation, there's a few people who react differently to alcohol. And nobody knows why. And nobody knows why they're acting the way they are. And they don't know they're getting an unnatural reaction. The people around them don't know they're not. But the unnatural, so you say, what is the unnatural reaction? Makes you stay drunk all the time? Yeah. We talk about that, but no human body can stay drunk 2 straight weeks, day and night, in a laboratory. You always get sober. Is it that makes you act crazy? Some people do. Some speakers have great funny stories about how crazy they've been. But I see people die who've never acted crazy once. They get more and more catatonic. They get so within themselves they can't function. Well, it can't handle it? No. Any number of tests indicate alcoholics can handle the amount of alcohol better than non-alcoholics. Even the Yale Institute of Alcoholic Studies discovered that in 1958, and they didn't know it was about. Then what is it? What is it that alcohol does to this 5 or 6% to you and me, Billy, that it doesn't do to most people? Nothing, really. Nothing. It does less to us than it does to them. What it does something special for us that it doesn't do for them. You can describe it in many ways, but put it this way. Alcohol has the unnatural ability to almost instantly make everything all right. It's hard to realize it doesn't do that for most people. That's why they don't drink. It isn't because they're morally better or even psychologically better. But as my sponsor pointed out to me, and I discovered later to be true, that when most people drink, it goes blah, blah, blah. But when I drink, and you drink, Billy, it goes... Probably the best example that I haven't thought about for years, the example in living in El Paso. My wife and I were waiting for household finance to call to see if they were going to repossess our furniture because I was a little behind. And we were so nervous. And God, we're just waiting on the phone. I'd made a terrible plea. And fortunately, I had some rum in a wicker basket that I got in Juarez. And I offered my wife some, but she, like all wives ever, no, no. You want me to make you crazy, make me crazy like you are? What's wrong? When the phone rang, I was the only one prepared to answer it. You keep up this crap, we ain't going to borrow from you anymore, asshole. I noticed they didn't take our furniture. They knew who they were dealing with then. But it gives me something special. I didn't know it's special, and people around me don't know they're getting it. And the trouble is, if it does that for me, it begins to freeze my emotional growth. And little by little, drinking gets to be a dependency. My emotional growth stays. My body stays. My brain has a drinking problem. So I stopped drinking, and I discover sobriety is more painful than it used to be. So I had to drink to stay sober. Then I have to drink. Then I have to stay sober. And that phenomenon is called alcoholism. And nearly everyone who has it dies from it saying, but I'm not really an alcoholic. My problems came when I was sober. I just drank to get some relief, and now it's a little out of hand. And they don't know they've defined the disease of alcoholism. And the reason that's important to know for the newcomers and me, to realize that pain and sobriety is a natural phenomenon of your recovery. That's why we are here. Being sober is not the goal here. Being sober is the entrance to AA. The natural state of untreated sober alcoholics is growing anxiety and depression and desperation. And what we are able to do here, if you allow yourself to do it, is to allow someone who knows more about it than you, we call him a sponsor, to direct that pain to make you take actions that you never would have taken if you hadn't been so pained and desperate. My recovery in AA is due to allowing someone to force me to do things when I was in suicidal depressions. Take an inventory the day I lost my job as a dishwasher, finally, after all those months. For crying out loud. Lucille, reach over and tweak her nose. Tell you, in the old days, we were sincere when we were new. Even when we slipped. There's a better way to put it. You know, analogy, it's an old analogy, but still true. Flying across the country, they're looking out the window and seeing that jets pushing us at 550 miles an hour, the plane lands. The same jets stop us because they change the direction of the thrust. That's all, the same things. And that's the same with pain. The same pain that makes me have to drink, if I can allow it to be steered, will make me take actions that means I don't have to drink. And that's what all it's hard to do. And the reason it works in AA is because we have a feeling of, that's why it's so necessary to have identification. That's why alcoholics must talk to alcoholics, because in the history of AA, every meaningful change from Ebby to Bill, from Bill to Dr. Bob, from Bill and Dr. Bob to Bill D in the hospital accident, they all wrote later. They made me feel as though they understood how I felt. The answer is always the same. It is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough
so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe. And that is what AA is. Everything else is frill. The book, the meetings, love, understanding, kindness, it is all secondary helps to that dynamic. And that's why it doesn't make any difference how similar a gambler is to me or an overeater or a narcotic addict. When they tell me about their problems, I understand. I don't understand what it's like to overeat. Don't understand what all these programs were founded by members of AA who also had that problem and realized they could not be helped by Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why it's so ridiculous people come here and thinking they're getting by pretending to be alcoholics. They don't lack. Identity is not there. And the other thing I want to tell you, Billy, before I sit down, I never had to return to God once. I thought I did, and I couldn't bear it. And it turned out I didn't have to return to God. As my sponsor pointed out to me, there's nothing in a book that says you ever return to anything. You're coming from sick perceptions. You got to find new things. He says there's only one line in the book that talks about returning to anything. It talks about returning to normal living. And a little puke like you never had any. So you have to worry about that. Just do something else. And you read the second step, and sure enough, it never says return to God. It says came to believe that some power greater than myself. I couldn't accept God. My sponsor said to me, can't you accept God? No, I can't. You believe in AA? No, I don't. She says, you think I'm doing better than you are? Yes, I do. Congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And he became my higher power, and I could accept that because he couldn't send me to hell. I would play his little sick little game with him. And I took actions for him, and when he intimidated me, that I never did for anybody else. And I'll tell you something. People say, you can't have your sponsor for your higher power. That's sick. I'm going to tell you something, Billy. I would rather see you believe in your sponsor that you believe in than pretend to believe in a God you don't believe in. Because at 2 o'clock in the morning, you can't fool the dark. You better have somebody out there that you can get in touch with. And I believe that. No, I'm not going to stop talking. You can't stop. I guess they hear the dance music. Your feet get up. That's right, yeah. That's that Mary N. Got your name on the tape, Mary. But I took actions, and I eventually came to believe in AA, and I eventually came to believe in a loving God. I took, the day I took my inventory, my sponsor had me tell him things I'd never had told my psychiatrist. And he said, why won't you tell your psychiatrist? Because you're paying that kind of dough, you can't afford rejection. Get out of my office, you sicko. I just deal with humans. Sponsors, what do they care? They're, oh, that's interesting, huh? That's the funny thing. He took me for a ride along the ocean, gave me a flashlight, and I read my fifth step to him. I thought, they're going to make me get out, and he did. I've taken that same ride over 200 times since then with some other boob over there with his flashlight. And I just, every time I wish there'd be something new in this one, just anything. But there never is anything new. It's always variations. There are only so many things you do with your mind and body. It's only important to the person doing it because they cannot get over the idea, I'm different. I'm different. And someday you'll come to understand you're not different. You're not different. And that's a great gift to understand that, because even knowing you're not different, sometimes you feel different. And I came to believe in a power greater than myself, and then he had me make an amend to the one man who would ruin my life, the one man that made me, I drank for 8 years as a victim over my father, because he wanted so much of me, and he never backed me up when I needed it. And when my problems, when my son died, he turned his back on me. When my family and I didn't have much, he turned his back on me. He deserted my mother and I was a little boy and went off with some other woman that I hated. On and on. I thought, that son of a bitch! The time I needed him, I ran away to sea. I couldn't, because nobody cared. I made a case for, like, and he had me write a letter of amend to him. Can you imagine? And I said, Jesus! This